Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. After 21 novels, including 18 New York Times bestsellers, Jane Green is now the head of Emerald Audio, a new podcast network producing original audio dramas for busy women, giving them the time to listen to great stories from some of the best-loved writers in the world while navigating their full lives. But Jane, we cannot forget, you have published in over 25 languages and you have over 10 million books in print worldwide. Like, my mind is blown. I'm such a huge fan. I had my sister join us for a minute before we started recording because she is obsessed with Jane. Jane, you don't stop. You just don't stop.
I don't know where it comes from, but I do feel like the Energizer Bunny at times. Although I have two modes. I have on and off. And on is slightly insane, but off means lying in bed, doing nothing, sometimes for days and occasionally weeks at a time. So I think that's how I manage to do it all.
Well, I also know that your home is your oasis. I think it's a good thing to have a place where you feel serenity all the time. I don't have that in my home right now because we have two dogs that are not very serene, but I'm glad that you have that place to go.
I'm a tremendous nester. And as long as my home feels like a safe sanctuary for me, I can go out and conquer the world, but I need to have that very solid, cozy home. And that's the thing with my homes. Even when we moved back to London for a few months during the pandemic and we were in a little rented apartment, but even then I had to make it feel like a cozy hug. As soon as you walk in, I want to feel like my house is hugging me.
I love that sentiment. Well, of course, you're great with words. Okay, so you started your career as a journalist. And I think it's funny because you left that world to start writing books. But now you are back, in a way, in journalism as the New Daily Mail Dear Jane editor. So it is full circle, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was with my eldest son yesterday and we would talk because he's graduating coming up this May.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm talking about sort of what to do in the world and about how so much in life happens because of who you know. And ultimately, people work with people they like. And actually, the Daily Mail thing, it is back to my journalistic roots, but it's also working with people that I worked with in my 20s who are still amongst my gracious friends. And I'm a very firm believer. I have in my time burnt a couple of bridges, but mostly I don't. And I believe in working very hard to not burn bridges because it's all about who you know. And you'd be amazed at how people circle back to you.
Yeah, you're totally right. Wait, that's so funny that you just said you burned bridges. But was it by accident or on purpose?
I think at the time it was on purpose. I think of one agent particularly that it was not the right fit. It was very clear that it was not the right fit. And I think that my nose was really put out of joint by some of her behavior. And I didn't deal with the ending of that well. it was kind of subterfuge. I was lining up other people and there was no grace in the way it ended. I don't have regret about that relationship no longer being in my life, but I have regret about the way it ended. I think that's probably the only bridge I've burned. I've definitely, you know, the thing with work is when you leave a publisher, it should just be professional, but it never is because, of course, you're mostly dealing with women. And so it's always personal as well. And I know it can be very upsetting when an author leaves. But with the exception of that one agent, I've always stayed great friends with my former editors, with my former agents. And I absolutely believe there is a way to do it where you can be grown up. And even if it at the time may blow up a little bit, I think there's always room to come back and talk about what happened and apologize if needed.
Yeah, for sure. So your journey has been incredible. You sort of left that original role in journalism and you're like, I'm going to write a book. And then you just did. Most people don't just do that. How did it sort of come so easy? But then more importantly, you've been able to just rinse, repeat over and over again with these incredible stories. So it must be in your blood somehow.
I think the thing that's really in my blood is a certain kind of fearlessness, particularly when young. And I remember somebody giving me that book, The Secret, years ago, and reading it and thinking, well, yeah. I mean, I somehow naturally had the belief that everything I did in the work arena would be a success or I wouldn't have done it. Of course, I had many failures, I think, along the way, but I didn't spend any time thinking about them. I just pivoted and did something else. If I was doing something that wasn't working, I just stopped and did something else and always presumed that it would work out. And I'm not quite sure where that came from. I think I had that for most of my life. I definitely got derailed a bit at the beginning of the pandemic with a series of changes in my career and changes in my friendships and a whole series of things that went on. For the first time in my life, I experienced anxiety and fear, which didn't come naturally to me. And I lived with that for a couple of years. And then sometime about a year and a half ago, I just thought, enough, you know, this is not the way to live. And I have to let go of that. And actually, I do feel that once I let go, the universe started immediately rewarding. It was like, oh, okay, now you're back.
She's back. Yeah, I was just going to say. So funny. Wait, when's your birthday? I'm just curious.
May 31st, Gemini.
Same.
Ah.
I kind of felt that you were when you were speaking, and I probably should have looked before you came on, but I felt it because I think there is an element of positivity mixed with speed in us that makes it like you're so busy, you're doing a million things, you don't even have time to actually think about if it's working or not. You're just on to the next. And I think that you strike me as someone who has that.
Yes. And in fact, part of my journey now at this stage of my life is learning to slow down. Because, of course, when you move so quickly, you do make mistakes and you miss things and then have to clean them up. And now, especially running a podcast network and working with teams of people, I'm having to slow down. And it doesn't come naturally to me, but I see the value in it.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So you have this incredible ongoing career, obviously publishing books and creating these incredible characters. And we're going to get into Sister Stardust later because I can't even believe that it was inspired by a photograph. But what made you decide to even go into creating podcast network?
I was approached a couple of years ago by the founders of a big podcast company called Cadence 13.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They just sold it to Audacy, one of the big media giants, and they decided to leave it under Chris Corcoran, who was their partner, and they decided to set up something new. And they came to me a couple of years ago and they said, listen, we've sold Cadence, we're building a new company, and we have this idea to create scripted fiction on the podcast platform. And it doesn't really exist. And what we do know is we want to create a company where we own the intellectual property. And we'd like to partner with you. We feel that you're the right person and we will build a network for you and we will back you and provide all the sales and marketing distribution. And I immediately recognized it. Well, first off, as a tremendous business opportunity, because as publishing is changing and I don't want to say dying, but morphing into something that's very different from the publishing world that I have been familiar with. I was so demoralized actually by the changing of the industry and really thinking that I'm not sure that I want to keep telling stories. I have to keep telling stories because it's in my blood, but I don't know that this is the correct way to reach a large number anymore. And I also thought back to my childhood. I grew up in London listening to those BBC radio plays and I loved them because it's not an audiobook. There was a full cast and all the sound effects. And I remember so many times when I couldn't get out my car because I was so immersed in the story. And so I realized this is what I could do again. And so we have created this network and some of the shows are written by New York Times bestselling authors. And what they do is they come up with an idea and then we attach young script writers and we turn that idea into like a 6, 8, 10 part scripted series that's performed by a full cast of actors and soundscaped. And we have two shows that are out now, which are Rainbow Girl, which I wrote, and then The Key of Love by Jenna Blum. And it's something very new. It's also free. You stream them for free because we make our money from the advertising and sponsorship. And I'm having a blast because I'm at the very beginning of a whole new growth industry. We're doing something that isn't really being done on the podcast platform. So it's challenging because trying to bring a book reading audience onto the podcast platform to listen to stories is something that we talk about every day. But it's also the most exhilarating, exciting thing just to have a new challenge like this at this stage of my life. I couldn't have dreamt of anything that was better for me.
I mean, it sounds like such a natural evolution of what you're doing anyway. Yeah. Because, listen, you're never going to stop telling stories. And the medium in which you tell the story, I mean, I love the idea of like a full-blown scripted show on a podcast. That's incredible. But what else is happening that I'm seeing is so much of your work is also on TikTok. Are you paying attention to what's happening to Jane Green on TikTok?
What? Are you serious? What's happening on TikTok? I'm not even on TikTok.
Jane, I'm so glad we're having this discussion. Yes.
Oh, so much. What's happening?
Well, there are lots of fans talking about, I'm seeing stuff about Rainbow Girl. We can talk after and I can walk you through all of it. But TikTok has done something incredible for fiction. I mean, I'm jealous because my books are nonfiction, so I feel like I'm like left out of the party a little bit. But what it's done for fiction, I mean, book talk in general is this incredible genre of just people talking about these stories and these characters and then taking it into another realm. So for example, before we got on, I was scrolling through looking for Jane Green TikToks. And one of the ones was like, get ready with me, inspired by Sister Stardust. And it's this whole 60s vibe look of like the style, right? Of Claire, basically. So there's obviously stuff that you're doing in the podcasting world, but then there's a whole nother realm of opportunity for you on TikTok.
Well, there is and there isn't, because the interesting thing about TikTok, and we all know the story of Colleen Hoover, who now
makes
the charts, and her career was really built on TikTok. And she is a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. And that's the thing with TikTok. You can't pay for it. You can't reach out to TikTok. You know, it's generic. It just happens. So for the lucky ones, if you are anointed by the TikTok gods, then it is very powerful.
You know what it is? It's people are passionate about your work and the work of other authors too. But the point is, they're using their platforms to talk about these characters, to talk about the stories. So there is a lot on there about you, even though you're not there.
Well, in about an hour, I will be there.
You know, it's funny. I was on social media very, very early and I started in fashion in the early days. The traditional press, as you well know, was very much, we don't need to do that. We are the OGs of media. We are print magazines. It was a whole different world. And I think my mentality was always, well, if you're not going to be there and someone's talking about you, then you're leaving it open for someone else to speak on your behalf, right? So there is really an opportunity, even as a cameo, for you to come on and be like, hey, everyone, I'm Jane Green. Thanks so much for all these posts. I think it's really exciting, though. And I also think it's so interesting for fiction in particular, where, you know, older books can all of a sudden take on a life of their own.
Yeah. You know, my first huge bestseller over here, which actually remains, I think, my biggest seller, was Jemima Jay. And yes. I do wonder what would have happened had it come out in the age of TikTok, because it was very controversial. Weirdly, a lot of people misunderstood the message. And this was a Cinderella story of an ugly duckling who turns herself into a swan with weight loss. And this was, you know, back in the day where there was no body positivity. Either you were skinny or you felt tremendous shame. And in fact, my character, Jemima, in losing all this weight, she goes to the other extreme. And the whole point of the book was neither makes you happy, whether it's compulsive overeating or, you know, binging, purging, restricting. She couldn't find happiness until she let it all go and found balance. But a lot of people felt that it was, it actually was a story about how you had to be thin to be happy, which it just wasn't at all. But it was a huge, huge book. And to this day, if I ever give a talk, I'll stand up in a room full of women and, you know, I can talk. And the minute I mentioned Once Upon a Time, I wrote a book called Jemima Jay, there is this audible, you know, everybody just still loves Jemima. And you said earlier, your sister, I just met your sister and she's been reading me since Jemima.
Yeah, I think it had a lot of impact on people. I also think a lot of people can relate to that. And listen, I think for the people who had that reaction, they probably didn't read the whole book, right? Because I think if you're just reading a blurb, you might think it is centered around, okay, weight loss brings happiness. But if they had read the book, they wouldn't have thought that.
Yes, I don't know. Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? Okay, Sister Stardust, inspired by a photograph. So you see this photograph and tell us what happens.
So growing up, there was a very famous photographer in the UK called Lord Lichfield. He was a cousin of the Queen, and he was the big society photographer in the 60s and 70s. And when I was a teenager, I stumbled upon a photograph. It was probably in a magazine of this incredibly beautiful woman who was lounging on a rooftop in what looked like Morocco, palm trees and a mosque in the background. And she was wearing this exquisitely embroidered caftan and very, very beautiful, with a look in her eye that I identified as sadness, although I later discovered that she was so stoned during that photo shoot.
That's so funny.
And behind her was a man in a hooded robe. And I was so struck by this photograph, by everything about this couple and where they were. And I could never find out very much. What I did find out was that her name was Talita Getty. She was Dutch, but had been raised mostly in London. And she had married the son of the richest man in the world. And together they had this extraordinary life. She was a muse of Yves Saint Laurent. They were best friends with the Rolling Stones. And anyone who was anyone stopped off at this extraordinary palace that they restored in Marrakesh that was, from the outside, you saw nothing but a stone wall and a little wooden gate. But you'd step through the gate and you were in Arabian Nights, in these courtyards, fountains and peacocks strutting. But of course, within 5 years, she was dead of a heroin overdose. And even today, over 50 years after she died, every major fashion designer will cite her as an influence, but there's so little written about her. And I think because it was a heroin overdose, and there was some mystery about it. Initially, they said it was an overdose of alcohol and barbiturates, because at the time, Italy had a mandatory 10-year prison sentence for possession of heroin. Mm. And her husband, Paul Getty Jr., seemed to have provided the heroin that she took. And so the Getty family, you know, these very wealthy, powerful families just shut down. So very little was written. And I had signed a new deal with HarperCollins, and it was supposed to be to write a sequel to a book that I'd written a few years ago called The Beach House, which was another very big hit. And they signed me on to write the sequel. And then out of nowhere, my editor said, Jane, have you ever thought about doing historical fiction? And I said, well, do the 60s count?
Yes, part of history.
Because he's 12 years old and wonderful, he said, yes. And so I told him what little I knew about Talita Getty. I said, I don't know what the story is, but I know there's a story here. And he just looked at me and said, I can see that you are passionate about this. This is the story you must write. And so then I had to spend the next year researching and trying to find information. And it was hard because there was so little. But I ended up making lists of people, anyone who had been in their circle or in that world, and read everything I could. And every now and then I'd find a page or a person or something that opened up a whole huge window into Getty's life, and particularly into Talita. And I ended up creating a protagonist who comes of age in London in the 60s, and she gets swept up by a very glamorous crowd and swept off to Marrakesh to stay with Paul and Talita Getty. And she and Talita become sort of enmeshed. I wanted to write about female friendship as well, and about the kinds of friendships that I think only women tend to have, where you meet somebody and it feels much like falling in love. You feel mm-hmm. like you've met a sister, a soulmate, a best friend. And it's this incredibly intense friendship where you feel seen and known for the first time. But as so often happens with these friendships, they burn so brightly that they end up burning out. And so that was the other theme of this book. So my protagonist, Claire, essentially falls in love with Talita and doesn't realize the danger that it has put her in.
Oh my God, it's such a good book. I'm in the middle, so I don't want to give it away. I don't want to talk anymore, but it is such a good book. And your ideas never stop. So you have your on and off buttons, your mental on and off buttons. When you're on, what drives you? What are the scenarios in which you perform best? How many hours a day do you write? What is your routine?
So when I'm writing, you know, honestly, I'm enormously disciplined. And that's really been the key. I was a journalist in my 20s. And I always say it was the most wonderful training, because I had an editor standing over me every day saying, Jane, we need 1,000 words on this in an hour. And I couldn't.
So true.
I'm so sorry. I'm not in the mood today. Try me tomorrow. You know, there is no muse when that's your job. You just write. And that is very much how I still write. I'm wonderful with a deadline. I'm a disaster if you give me all the time in the world.
Mm.
My day is also punctuated by periods of peacefulness. So whatever I'm doing, I have to ensure that there are pockets within that day, whether it's even 10, 15 minutes, where I can just breathe and have sort of downtime and quiet time and essentially regroup. That's really how I do it. I have worked on my own, because writing is such a solitary business, for many years. And it's one of the things I've discovered about myself at this stage of life, is that I long to collaborate. I love collaboration. And in fact, I'm lonely. I don't want to work alone anymore. And that's the beauty of the podcast network. I'm still creating stories, but now I'm working with other writers, and I'm working with them as a sort of showrunner and producer and editor. So I'm saying to them, listen, here's the outline of this story. Let's you and I together sort of turn it into something. And then they go off and write it. And creatively, it's tremendous fun. And love working with other people, but also still have to ensure that I have that time on my own throughout the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes perfect sense. I also think, listen, creativity is exhausting. I mean, you have to like give yourself a moment to reset. One of the things that you've said, advice for aspiring novelists, write what you want to write, not what you think will sell. Don't be put off by rejection. And don't hand your book out for everyone to read to seek validation. That is amazing advice. Hard to take. Why do you believe that that is the best advice for aspiring novelists?
I think that whenever we think we're going to write something that's capturing the zeitgeist or you're going to be a bestseller, the moment's gone and you're not writing from your heart. You have to write the story that is authentically you and the story that is crying out to be told. And as for the too many cooks, I mean, I understand it and I still want to do it. I want to give this book to everyone I know. But first of all, your friends are unlikely to be honest with you. You know, mostly they'll come back and say, it's fantastic. And even if they are honest, everybody will have a different opinion about what needs to be done. And you end up just twisting yourself into a pretzel. If, like me, you're a people pleaser, you believe every bit of criticism that comes your way and then twist yourself into a pretzel trying to figure out how to change your work. And so, you know, what I now say to people is, well, first of all, don't give it to anyone until you've done at least 3 drafts. I mean, you have to feel that it's the best it can possibly be before you give it to anyone. And then pick one person who you trust, who is a reader, and give it to them and ask for honest advice. And you must be willing to hear it. One of the things that nobody really talks about in writing is the amount of humility that's required to have a writing career. Because however good you may think you are and however good your words and however important your story, you need to trust that when somebody says it's not good enough or it needs X, Y, and Z, you have to trust them.
You've done so many interviews. You've been on so many podcasts. What is one thing that you wish people would ask you that no one ever does?
Oh, I don't know, really. I have an opinion on everything. So I love tending to be an expert on everything.
Hence Dear Jane.
And it's really funny because I'm the new advice columnist for the dailymail.com, which is the most visited news website in the world. So it's pretty daunting knowing that millions of people could be looking at your answers and you don't want to get it too wrong. Well, I'm beginning to realize 4 weeks in that you also want it to be a little bit controversial. And as a people pleaser, I have a propensity to want to straddle the fence. I'm a bit Aaron Burr-like, you know, I don't want to upset anyone. So I'll sort of say what I think needs to be said, but then counter it with something else. And actually, this week, one of the letters that I answered was, I'm a single mother of a 6-year-old daughter and I've given her whatever she wants. But now my friends and family are saying she's a monster and she screams and throws tantrums if she doesn't get an extra bowl of ice cream and nobody wants to be with her. And actually, it was the first time I thought, all right, I'm taking this on and I'm going to say exactly what I think because I have very strong opinions about parenting. And, you know, I have 6 kids, 4 of them are mine. And then I got 2 when I married my husband and they were all essentially raised with us. And people always used to say to me, oh my God, you're so lucky. Your kids are so wonderful. And they helped, you know, they came for dinner with my kid and then they cleared the table and you're so lucky. And I used to go, luck has nothing to do with it. You know, raising kids as a job and a responsibility and creating sort of structure and giving them responsibility, because actually your job is not to give them an idyllic childhood, although that would be lovely. Your job is to raise decent adults who can go out to the world and make their way and deal with all of the hardships and the tough stuff that life is going to throw at them.
Wait, so what did you tell her?
Well, towards the end of the letter, she said, you know, I don't see the problem in giving her an extra toy or an extra sleepover. And I said, you asked what the problem was. Well, here's the problem. You're raising somebody who is not going to have any tools to actually go out into the world. And I understand how hard it is. I was a single mother for about a second because I did fall in love with my landlord 3 days after my marriage broke. I mean, I didn't fall in love with him just then, but I rented a house and then fell in love with my landlord. So I wasn't single for very long, but I remember how overwhelming and exhausting it is. And of course, it's easier to stick your kid in front of an iPad and to give them the extra bowl of ice cream, because who wants to deal with the screaming? But the truth is, that's not what parenting is about. And I said to her, you're avoiding your job by saying yes, and you're doing your child no favors. Because the truth is, what children crave more than anything is structure and knowing where the boundaries are. They need to know when they've gone too far. And that means not giving in to the screaming and actually staying very calm, but having boundaries and consequences and sticking to it. And it's relentless and boring and really, really hard. But ultimately, you're not only giving your child huge advantages, like you're giving yourself a much easier life, because it's the Pavlovian response. As soon as they realize no means no, they're going to stop with the screaming and tantruming.
Yeah, so true. Oh my God, I'm so glad my kids are beyond that stage too. But yeah. Good answer. I'm sure she didn't like it, but good answer. So speaking of your falling in love with your landlord, I mean, I'm surprised this isn't a book in of itself. I was reading about Figlet's Manor. Tell people about Figlet's Manor.
Well, Figlet's Manor was an old house. We started off renting a house for 5 years, and then we decided to build our dream house. And once we built it, we realized that both of us hated living in a new house. We're not new house people. We actually like sort of creaky old antique houses that are slightly falling apart. And I also, I mean, obviously I'm English, so my sensibilities, I love everything that's a bit older, but the pressure that came with that house, I just, oh God, I remember the first night we moved in, the dog scratched these like newly lacquered high gloss French doors. He got shut in and scratched them to pieces.
Oh my God, that's a nightmare. I can picture it.
Yeah, I almost had a nervous breakdown. I mean, these doors scratched pieces. And I just thought, I don't have the right constitution to live in a brand new perfect house. I need something that's shabby and that can get beaten up a bit. And actually, we called the house, the only thing, we bought a piece of land that had a house that was falling down on it. And the only thing that was worth saving was this amazing fig tree. And it was dripping with fruit. And I was so excited. I started gathering recipes. I had recipes for fig tarts and fig jam. On the day of closing, we went to the house and my attorney came with me because he said, I'd love to see this land. I said, come, you've got to come see the fig tree. And as we walked up the garden, I was like, where's the fig tree gone? And as I got closer, there was just a massive hole in the ground.
Oh.
The previous owners had dug up the fig tree on the day of closing and taken it with. And so as a joke, I called the house Figless Manor. And so Figless Manor it remained. But we sold that a few years ago. And then we bought an old house on the water, which I called Creaky Cottage because it was on a creek and it also creaked when the wind blew. And then tragically, we sold it 2 years ago and that was devastating for me. But, you know, with the publishing industry changing, being on the water, reading climate change, kind of knowing that we were probably going to have water in the house soon. If we did, we had to rebuild. And I didn't know whether we'd have the money. And so I just decided to get out while the market was good. So we are now in the mouse house, which is called that because really it should only be for mice. It's teeny tiny. It's a tiny little beach cottage, which we've owned forever. We've had it for 17 years. And it was a rental investment. It was never supposed to be a home, but now it's a home. And actually, I quite love it. I'm not quite ready for a house this small because I'm quite reclusive by nature and I'm a nester. I'm always at home. So entertaining for me means throwing my doors open and feeding people who come over. It's always open house. Everyone's welcome.
I love that. And your kids, by the way, I'm sure they're around too.
They're all at college now, but during the summer they're around and our homes have always been the hangout homes. So
my house is too. I love that. Jane, you have so many facets to you. And I know obviously you're this hugely successful writer, but I feel like you could have been a chef. You could have been an interior decorator. I mean, you have so many different interests that you're good at. Is there ever a notion in your mind that in the future you might delve into another one of these interests?
Well, when I wrote Sister Stardust, I got so obsessed with that world. I mean, all I read for a year were books that were about the 60s or, you know, memoirs of the 60s. I was born in 1968, but I think I should have really have come of age in 1968. And I mean, I'm what you can't see. I'm wearing my bell bottom flares and everything is kind of inspired by the 60s. But I started painting again. I started sketching the characters and, you know, I had this, actually, you can see my Keith Richards.
Oh, I love that. Fabulous.
I started kind of drawing some of the characters that appear in Sister Stardust. And then, inspired by Talita's caftan, I did a painting and had it printed onto fabric and did a line of caftans and snake necklaces, which I sold. Yeah, I think it's entirely possible that I'm fueled by creativity and I never quite know how that's going to come out, whether it's painting, creating a line of clothing, sort of feeling. I was thinking about the column because the comments are brutal. And I quite like reading them because it reminds me how necessary it is for a wise, warm, compassionate voice. And we may not write into an advice columnist, but the number of people who just don't have anyone to turn to give them advice. And I think there is such a need for this. But then I was thinking, oh, tea and sympathy. That's sort of what I'm offering. But I'm not really a tea drinker, but I am a tequila drinker. You know, who doesn't love a Casamigos? But there's always room for one more.
I love that. Oh my God. And you know, it's so funny. Most people don't read the comments section of any site, social media, anything. But you want to know what they're saying.
And some of them are really brutal and I've been, you know, called all kinds of terrible things. And actually, I also, the more I read the comments, the less they affect me. So I think that's quite important as well. I want to get to a place where they have no effect at all. Because I remember somebody saying to me years ago, don't take criticism from anybody from whom you wouldn't take advice.
Good advice.
That was so true. And actually, you know, the people who are making these comments are not people that you would ever, you know, most of them are not people whose opinion you would ever care about if you got them in real life. And the fact that they're able to sit behind a keyboard and type vicious anonymous comments, I mean, it doesn't matter. And I just need to get to a place where it really doesn't affect me.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you're probably there because you're so right. It's like literally meaningless. I'm so excited to see how all of this shakes out. And I know you have so many more surprises for us. Last question on the show is always the same. How do you ultimately want to leave your mark? What do you want Jane Green to be known for?
I mean, it's not so much making the world a better place, but I think making a small difference in people's lives for the better. And I think the messages that drive me through life, one of the primary ones is gratitude. I mean, humility, gratitude, thinking about other people, but also thinking about the impact that your behavior and your words and your being has on those around you. You know, if I can make any kind of difference in anybody's life and make them think about those things, that would be the legacy I would want to leave.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Jane, you are a force. I mean, the talent is off the charts. I'm so honored to have you on the show. And thank you so much for spending an hour with me.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Leave Your Mark. If you want more career advice or tips on personal branding, make sure to pick up a copy of my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception. Want to land your dream job or kill it in your career? Don't forget about my first book, Leave Your Mark. If you want me to speak at your company or at an offsite, or if you need consulting services, please go to alizalick.com. I would love to connect with you there and on social media. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.